Okay, if you would join me in prayer this evening. Our Father in heaven, we come before you. We're so thankful to you. We appreciate you. We love you. We ask your blessing and guidance this evening in the teaching and instruction and the listening, the comments, the discussion. It will be edifying, uplifting, that all credit goes to you, Father. Thank you for your calling. Thank you for your truth. Thank you for opening our minds. And Father, help us to remember our relationship has got to be individually with you and your son, not through a minister, not through a church, not through any organization. And there's still way too many people that don't get that. So help us to understand that and to appreciate the sacrifice of what you and your son together, because you're the one that ultimately had to turn your back on your son who represented sin for that few moments, and how hard that must have been to watch him go through what he did, plus what he did. And we'll be talking about that Sabbath. So we just ask your blessing, your protection, bless the transmission and the reception. Father, give us peace. Help us to not get wrapped up in all the news and all the doom and gloom. And as things continue to not go so well, we want to make your people and your truth and your way of life and your it's not just the kingdom, it's what comes after that, even to make all of what you intended your family to be great, because it's never been great with human beings from the beginning, because we're human. And so if we get focused in on make America great again, that's not what we need to be focused on, and that becomes politicized and takes us down rabbit holes that are not spiritually edifying. So we ask your blessing. Thank you. Turn this over to you and praise you. In Jesus Christ's name, we ask this. Amen. Okay. We are in, let me see. Who should I ask on this? Who remembers what chapter we're on tonight? Okay. Anybody?
13.
Is that Clark? Mr.
Yeah,
Clark? All
13.
right. You're a good man. I got to keep you. You know, you're a good guy. All right. Chapter 13 is where we are in 1 Samuel. And it's an interesting chapter. I'm not going to ask this time how many of you read it ahead of time, because that will put some of us in the cat box for a little bit. So I hope you do. That will make it easier for you to understand and for me to go through it. We start out chapter 13. The very first verse. Some of you, if you read it, are going to scratch your head and say, why does it say this? Well, I have some comments on, and this is for Eric, I have comments on almost all the verses. And I'm going to say, I have comments on verse 2 and verse 3 and verse 4, Eric. So, but verse 1, Saul reigned 1 year, semicolon, I think it is. Maybe it's a colon, but I think it's a semicolon. And when he had reigned 2 years over Israel. Now, if any of you read that, you thought, what in the world? Saul reigned 1 year, and when he had reigned 2 years. What kind of sentence is that? Now, it records the beginning of his reign. Translations vary between him being 30 years old and reigning for 42 years, what it says in the NIV. Or reigning for 1 to 2 years initially, which is the English Standard Version and the King James Version. But what it does is it sets the stage for a critical point in his kingship where he establishes a standing army to combat the Philistines. Now, the Hebrew text is notoriously difficult. I took just enough time to dig into it to decide, eh, not today, Zerg, as Buzz Lightyear would say. If you don't get that, ask my wife. She'll tell you later. But the Hebrew text is notoriously difficult, with some versions noting he was 30 years old when he became king. Others simply note his initial 1 to 2 year reign. Following this, and we're going to start reading through this, Saul establishes a 3,000-man army, and we'll read about this, with 2,000 under his command at Michmash Bethel and about 1,000 under Jonathan at Gibeah. It introduces this verse. This chapter introduces a major turning point where Saul acts as a military leader in leading to a conflict. Now, just one more comment on the obscurity of the. Oh, Harry's back. So he's not in the ambulance yet. All right. And somebody else is back. And after this, they may have to stay out. Okay. Some translations, such as the English Standard Version, indicate the original Hebrew text for this verse is so obscure or missing numbers results in all these variations between different Bible translations. So that's what that first verse, you may have just read over it and said, it doesn't matter to me. Well, maybe it doesn't matter, but maybe it does. Maybe it's a case of mind over matter. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter. All right, verse 2. Saul chose him 3,000 men of Israel, whereas, or whereof, 2,000 of that 3,000 were with Saul in Michmash, which I'll be commenting later, and in Mount Bethel, and 1,000 were with Jonathan in Gibeah of Benjamin. And the rest of the people he sent every man to his tent. So this describes Saul. He's got a standing army of 3,000 men to fight the Philistines or combat them. And Saul, it specifically says 2,000 with Michmash and Bethel and 1,000 in Gibeah. And the rest of them were dismissed to their homes, which I'll comment about in a bit. And it was a preparation, a setup for a conflict with the Philistines, setting the stage for, as we're going to see after this chapter, Jonathan's attack on the garrison and go through that. This move that we read about marks a shift. For those of you, this is for Joe, the historian, from a temporary volunteer army to a more permanent force. But it also directly precedes the tension and the disobedience described later in the chapter. Now, there's something on here that all throughout chapter 13 and 14, if you read through this ahead of time, I'm going to mention the towns, not cities, but they're towns, if you will. You can call them cities, but they're more like towns. In chapters 13 and 14 of 1 Samuel, there's Bezek, Gilead, Shiloh, Gad, Ophir, Ephron, Bethel, Beth-Aven, Gilgal, Beth-Horon, Geba or Geba, Michmash, and Gibeah. Whoop-de-doo, right? Well, if you look at a map, and I suggest you do this, look at a map, you'll get a lot better picture of the battle. The battles that took place in all these different places, as you can see how it's laid out, it's interesting how God inspired all the locations to be mentioned. Why is that important? I'm not trying to make fun of anybody here. But with the recent conflict with Iran, which most of the United States, including educated people, are some of the most clueless people I've ever met in my life when it comes to geography. With the recent conflict with Iran and the countries affected, okay, and you look at all those in the Middle East, most people, they watch the news, they get all worked up, they watch the politics, they comment left and right, and I'm like, seriously, just be quiet, because they have no clue. Just make sure I got my Starbucks, my internet, and my smartphone. Pretty sad, huh? But that's where we live in. And, here's what I've found. Here's what I've found is the absolute just no understanding of world geography. Like, when did the Russian-Ukraine war start? Well, it was just a couple years ago, right? No, it was way longer than 4 years, folks. I wrote a whole letter about this for those of you that read it. And so this thing, if you want to know why you have all these different things going on in the Middle East, go back and read your Bible and look at what took place when they were kids. This has been throwing sand, killing each other. You go back to Cain and Abel. You can learn from that, the First World War that wiped out a quarter of the Earth's population. And you start going through and you understand. And so God, when we go through this, he lists all these places. I used to tell brethren in a lot of the different places that I pastored, you have maps in the back of your Bible. They're not the best, but now that we have AI, which just tells you everything completely accurate, ha ha ha, look at where some of these locations are. I say, go look at why there's this going on in Dubai, okay? Or Qatar, or wherever it's happening. A lot of people are like, well, isn't Israel next to one person? I'm not kidding. I was talking to somebody walking the other day. They were all flustered on their phone, and I asked them what they were, oh, just worked up. And they said, poor President Trump, he's got to deal with Iran, and right next door, he's got Cuba, and then right on top of Cuba, he's got Taiwan. And I thought they were joking, but they're not. Because some of them have never been out of Alabama their whole life. And I'm not making fun of them, but what's going on, it's like a lot of this stuff, and we're going to see this as we go through this chapter tonight. It directly addressed things. It directly addresses things that we might not think about. Okay, Annie, before we go on to verse 3, why would the rest of the people, would he send every man to his tent? I want you to think about that. I don't need an answer right now. I just want you to think about it in the back of your head, because as we go through this, it's going to be abundantly clear why he did that. Verse 3. And Jonathan smote the garrison of the Philistines that were in Geba, or Geba, and the Philistines heard of it, and Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land. Man, he must have had one set of lungs. Reminds me of the story of King David when he had a motorcycle. You all know that story, right? He said the sound of his triumph would hurt throughout the land. Right? Okay. So Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land, saying, boy, he must have had a large, loud voice too. Let the Hebrews hear. So you've got an escalation of war. Because Jonathan, Saul's son's attacking a Philistine outpost or a garrison at Geba. And this act of defiance prompted Saul to summon all the Hebrew people to battle by blowing a trumpet or a ram's horn throughout the land, effectively initiating a revolt against Philistine control. So Jonathan attacks the Philistine garrison in Geba. The Philistines hear about the attack. Saul rallies the Hebrews for war by blowing a trumpet. And this verse now, as we're starting, marks a major escalation in the conflict between Israel and the Philistines. And all of Israel, verse 4, all of Israel heard say that Saul had smitten a garrison of the Philistines, and that Israel also was had in abomination with the Philistines. What's that mean? Well, I will translate that in a second. And the people were called together after Saul to Gilgal. So here this verse records that after Jonathan strikes the Philistine outpost, Israel hears the news that Saul had attacked the Philistine garrison. Israel becomes despised or a stench in the nostril of the Philistines. And so in response, the people were summoned to join Saul at Gilgal to prepare for obviously expected retaliation. So they learned, they got the report that Saul or his forces, led by Jonathan, attacked the garrison and Philistines. The action made Israel, one of the war translations said, odious, a stench, or despicably despised and hated even more by the Philistines. I would say right now that this nation and our president is odious, a stench, or hated despicably by those people in Iran, wouldn't you say? Fair enough. Probably more so than. No, I better not say that. I was going to say the folks that had all this money they were laundering in Minnesota. So the Israelite people are called to assemble and join Saul at Gilgal. The escalation of the conflict, where a bold act of war by the Israelites, specifically Jonathan, turned the political situation into a direct confrontation with the Philistines. Here's a question. Does it sound like any of the wars going on in the world right now? Or might I add, if you don't see it coming, for those that are going to follow. Okay, verse 5. And the Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel. And since the Israelites had 3,000, they had 3,000 chariots at no. The Philistines gathered themselves together to fight with Israel, 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people as the sand which was on the seashore in multitude. And they came up and pitched in Michmash eastward from Beth-Aven. There was a movie years ago. I don't recommend you watch it. It was called Storm Ship Troopers or Star Troopers or something like that, where there was this planet with these bugs that would come down, and they just kept coming, and they would mow them down with machine guns, and they just kept coming. They eventually killed everybody. Sort of reminds you of the story of the Zulu warriors that I used in a sermon not long ago. So this describes a massive Philistine army assembling at Michmash to fight Israel. 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and soldiers so numerous it was like the sand in Orange Beach. That overwhelming force terrified the Israelites, causing them to hide in caves and pits while Saul waited for Samuel at Gilgal. It was a formidable army to combat Israel, wouldn't you say? While the King James Version mentions 30,000 chariots, many modern translations, the NIV, the NLT, note that this number may be a copyist error and refer simply to 3,000 chariots. I don't know. Why do I bring that up? Because every time I post this on public, somebody sends me a note and says, "You were inaccurate. This is the correct number." Okay, so that's why I mention it. It's a very strategic location. The Philistines camped at Michmash east of Beth-Aven. That's nowhere near Brookhaven, which Brookhaven is where a friend of ours lives. But Beth-Aven. There's this context of overwhelming fear, and it sets the stage for the Israelites' fear, leading many to hide in caves, thickets, rocks, holes, cisterns. And part of the reason Saul said, "Go back home and go into your houses. Go hide." Do you know what we do now, folks? You know what we do now? When we are fearful, we stay home. We don't go anywhere. We don't travel. We don't go out to eat. We don't want to go to the store any more than we have to. And so the panic that took place, the sheer size of the army caused Saul's troops to tremble and scatter. And then we're going to get into and see what prompted Saul to take matters in his own hands by offering a sacrifice, which led to his rejection as king. Verse 6. When the men of Israel saw they were in the strait, for the people were distressed, as the three little pigs said, they were. What? I'll huff and I'll puff. And the three little pigs were sore afraid. They were flat scared to death. Their legs did tremble and their bowels were loosened. And so the people were distressed. And the people did hide themselves in caves and all thickets, rocks, places, and pits. And some of the Hebrews went over Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. As for Saul, he was still in Gilgal, and all the people were following him, trembling. And he waited 7 days. 7 days of waiting that long would make 1 week. According to the set time, some of you got that. According to the set time that Samuel had appointed, he told him, wait 7 days. But Samuel didn't just show up at Gilgal. And the people were scattered from him. Now we have what I call the first great sin of Saul. Saul said, bring me a burnt offering and peace offering. And he offered the burnt offering. There's two things that are happening here. One, he's incredibly impatient, which is surprising because earlier he was sort of patient in previous chapters. He's not now. And he also had a presumptuous ego problem. You all know what presumptuous is, right? Do you want to know why God did not allow Moses to go in the promised land? It had nothing to do with striking the rock, even though he had an attitude. What happened was God said, speak to the rock and I will bring water. We all heard that. God said, Moses, speak to the rock and I will bring water. So Moses whacks away on the rock, frustrated, sick and tired of the whining of the Israelites. And then he says to them, the water starts to come out. He says to them, look what we have done. And God said, what? We? Who do you think you are? It wasn't the first time. And so God said, you presumptuous? This is bad. You really need to learn what you just did. You don't do that. Don't take credit when the credit goes to God. Herod Agrippa learned that the hard way too. The worms ate him from the inside out. And so Saul said, okay, in verse 10, it came to pass that as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, behold, here comes Samuel. And Saul went out to meet him that he might salute him. I want to tell you a quick funny story, and you may not think this is too funny, but it wasn't funny what had happened, but it's funny now. In 1981, I was in Big Sandy, Texas. They reopened the Ambassador College campus, sent 50 of us down from California, and we really liked Big Sandy. I did a lot better than, no offense, Clark. I love California, but I came from Nebraska, and California took me a while to adjust. I really liked it, but not like Texas. And so I was in Big Sandy, and it was more of a laid-back atmosphere. And one of the policies we had in Texas that we didn't have in Pasadena was if an instructor was more than 10 minutes late for his class, you could leave and there would be no penalty. You wouldn't get in trouble. And I liked that because then I would have an hour and a half to go do something else. And I wouldn't get in trouble because sometimes a professor would be 30 minutes late. And sometimes they just wouldn't show up. Well, I'll never forget this because there was an evangelist at that time by the name of Ronald D. Kelly. He had a beard and nice toupee on his head. And nice guy, knew him well. But we had a class with him one day, and the clock's ticking, and he's not there. And he wasn't there. And 10 minutes went by, and nobody was going to say anything because we had all come from Pasadena. We were like, you don't do this. We leave, we're in trouble. Nobody did. Finally, at 15 minutes, I thought, hey, I'll do it. So I stood up in front of the class. The entrance to the class was behind me in a door. And I stood up and the problem was I used his voice when I said it. And I said, well, class, since I'm not here at 10 minutes, you're free to go home. And it was dead silence and nobody laughed. And I thought, okay, that normally you would have laughed at that. And I heard this booming voice right behind me. Oh, no, you can't, because I am here now. And it was, I'll never forget that. So here you have Saul waits the week, and I can see it. He does this offering, all right? And as soon as he gets done at the end, here comes Samuel. And it made me think of that. And Saul went out to meet him, and he might salute him. Hey, how are you? Good to see you. I'm not going to tell you what I just did, but I'm glad you're here. You took you a little bit, you know. And verse 11, and Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "I blew it. I really messed up. I sinned." But no, instead, he turns on his defense mechanism and justifies what he did. "I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you didn't come within the days you said you would, and that the Philistines gathered themselves together. Somebody had to do something because you weren't here." So Samuel confronts King Saul for violating the divine instruction by performing an unlawful sacrifice. What have you done? One of Saul's weaknesses was always making excuses. Do you remember when he said, "Kill everything that breathes"? He said, "Well, you got to understand. This is how I saw it and why I did this." So his disobedience by citing a shrinking army, Samuel's delay, and the impending attack of the Philistines. It highlights Saul's fear, his impatience, his disobedience, and it marked a huge, dramatic turning point in his reign and the eventual rejection of his kingdom. Samuel, when he said, "What have you done? What hast thou done? What have you done?" Saul justifies his actions because his men were running away. "Samuel, you were late, and the Philistines are all getting this army." And he says, "I had to force myself to offer a burnt offering." How do you force yourself? "Come on, self. You got to do this now. I'm to come on, you can do it, right?" I don't read that. And he offered a burnt offering, a duty reserved for priests and prophets like Samuel. Samuel calls it a foolish, disobedient act leading to the prophecy that Saul's kingdom is not going to endure. And what is this event? It demonstrates the danger of prioritizing panic over obedience and trying to manage spiritual matters with what? Our own human reasoning. And thankfully, we never do that, do we? We do it all the time. Well, God will understand. Oh, he understands. The children of Israel were really good at it. And we're good at it. And we shouldn't be. Okay, so therefore, verse 12, said I, this is funny. Saul says, "Therefore I said, the Philistines will come down upon me to Gilgal, and I have not made supplication unto the Lord. So I went against my mental conscience, an attitude of minimizing my sin." This was not a little matter in God's eyes, by the way. "I forced myself, therefore, and I offered this burnt offering." And verse 13, Samuel says, "Hey, I get it, man. We all make mistakes. It's okay. God will forgive you. God loves you. The blood of sacrifice of Christ will cover you eventually. So just don't worry about it, okay? It's all good." No, it's not what happened. He gets a warning to Saul to clean up his act. And Samuel said to Saul, "You have done, you've been a fool. You're stupid. You're not thinking. You have not kept the commandments of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now would the Lord have established your kingdom upon Israel forever." He would have if you obey him. So the NIV reads, "You have done a really foolish thing. You have not kept the commandment." This is from the NIV. "The Lord your God gave you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom over Israel for all time." So this rebuke follows King Saul's unauthorized sacrifice, leading to the rejection of his dynasty. Saul was instructed to wait for Samuel at Gilgal to offer sacrifices before battling the Philistines. Fearing that his retreating army and waiting 7 days, Saul said, "I can't wait any longer. I waited this time. He's not here." He offered the burnt offering himself, overstepping his royal non-priestly role. I remember one time having a conversation with a man in one of the congregations I pastored, and he said, "I'm going to baptize my son and lay hands on him so he'll receive God's Spirit." And I said, "Well, why do you want to do that?" I said, "I don't have a big problem with you baptizing him, but laying hands on him, that's a different story." He said, "You don't have any authority to tell me what I can do, and God will recognize it just like as if you do it." And I said, "Okay, then, go for it." And it was a few years later, he said, "Man, I wish I hadn't done that." He said, "But you didn't jump on me for it. You just said, 'Okay, do whatever you think is right in your own eyes.'" And so, Saul, we could use any kind of reasoning we want. He didn't do what God said you're supposed to do. So Samuel tells Saul his actions were foolish, acting foolishly because he broke a divine command. Because of his lack of obedience, Samuel declares that God is not going to establish your kingdom forever. So this moment marks the turning point where God, as we're going to read, seeks a man after his own heart to replace Saul's dynasty. Verse 14, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought him a man after his own heart." Just by reference, you can look up Acts 13, verse 22. "And the Lord has commanded him to be captain over his people because you have not kept that which the Lord commanded you." What this tells me, obedience to God is critical. It trumps those man-made regulations, administratives, thus saith the Lord's, that are men. Hence, we are to obey God rather than men in many cases. Where does that fall into place? I'll let you think about that and figure through that one. Verse 15. Verse 15. "And Samuel arose, and he got up from Gilgal into Gibeon of Benjamin, and Saul numbered the people that were present with him, about 600 men." So this verse here marks a significant transition in the King Saul's narrative reign. According to the English Standard Version, it says Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. And while Samuel left, King Saul counted the troops still with him. They now numbered only approximately 600 men. That's a pretty sizable decrease, kind of massive, if you will, from the 3,000 that Saul originally chosen. So it follows Saul's failure to wait for Samuel and his decision to offer an unlawful sacrifice himself. The judgment's pronounced. Immediately before this verse, Samuel informed Saul his kingdom's not going to endure because you didn't obey God and keep his commandment. And Samuel reveals that the Lord had already sought out a different leader because he knew what Saul was going to do. A man after his own heart. A lot of people read that, oh, he was kind, he was loving. No, what it meant was he would obey God. Do you remember what Christ said? "Not my will, but your will be done," to his Father, over and over and over. "I can do nothing of myself, except my Father allows it." So many times. And yet people say, oh, it's all about Jesus. Well, he's an important part of it. I don't want to make light of that. But we are to obey our Father in heaven and our Lord and Master Jesus Christ. And so he set a man after God's own heart as to replace Saul as the leader over Israel. The count of only 600 men underscores Israel's desperate situation against the Philistines, who had amassed a massive army with thousands of chariots and horsemen. Now, I want to make a comment about the variation of the transcripts or the manuscripts. There's a notable difference between the Hebrew, which is the Masoretic, and text in the ancient Greek of the Septuagint, the LXX translation for this verse. The Septuagint version, some translations such as the NLT, the New Living Translation, include this longer passage from the Septuagint stating the rest of the troops went with Saul to meet the army as they moved from Gilgal toward Gibeah. And the standard Hebrew text, most English versions primarily follow the Hebrew text, which focuses on Samuel's departure, Saul's numbering, the 600 remaining soldiers. Okay, verse 16. And Saul and Jonathan, his son, and the people that were present with them abode in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. You can read that and read right past it, but these are both strategic positions for each one. For those of you that like to study military history, and I will tell you this, what's been going on from the United States to these other countries, Venezuela, now in Iran, there are other countries coming up next. Remember I told you that? There's going to be some incredible, interesting, and valuable military strategy and history from all this, if the average clueless American had a clue. But they don't. So these were strategic positions. That's why they're mentioned. Again, if you had a map, you would see that. Verse 17. And the spoilers, okay, the raiders, if you want to call it that, came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. One company turned under the way that led to Ophrah in the land of Shual. And I want to stop here for a minute because this army sending out raiders or spoilers in three companies to ravage the land of Israel was very strategic. It highlights, frankly, the vulnerability of Israel, which is, we're going to see why in a minute, was under-equipped for battle. Three companies, three raiding parties, if you will, they left the main Philistine camp. I remember on the fire department, we would respond to an accident scene or a fire or other situation. And we always had ABC. You had to look at the area as a whole, and then you had to decide what were you going to do that was the most effective for this multiple thing. You might have multiple people injured, multiple vehicles, multiple buildings, all these different things involved. And when you had any more than one, it was always nerve-wracking. Part of the reason my health is the way it is, because when that pager went off, I had to start, the brain had to be working. And you'd get in the truck and you'd have a very short time and you had to be wide awake, decisive right away. And you had sometimes five, six, seven things going on at once. And so he had three companies left the Philistine camp. They went in different directions to destroy the country, one toward Ophrah, one toward Beth Horon, and one toward the border of the Valley of Zeboiim. Why is this important? Because it occurred during a time when the Philistines held superior military technology. They had iron working, we're going to read about that, and the Israelites had almost no weapons. It demonstrates an absolutely severe threat the Philistines posed in the desperate situation for King Saul and his people just before they were forced to battle without proper weaponry. And another company turned the way to Beth Horon, another company, the border that looked to the Valley of Zeboiim toward the wilderness. Verse 19. Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. So there was no one there by the name of Smith, right? No, that's not what it's talking about. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make themselves swords or spears. It highlights there were no blacksmiths found in Israel because the Philistines prohibited them, fearing the Hebrews would forge weapons. Do you want to know one of the reasons the United States is a formidable foe against everybody? It's not because of our money necessarily. It's not because we have this incredibly advanced military, although it is, okay, if you will, advanced. Because they know that if they come into this country, unlike some of the other nations, especially those in Europe, any given household could have an arsenal to start picking them off and killing them. That's not a political statement. It's just a fact. And so, consequently, it mentions only King Saul and his son Jonathan possessed iron swords or spears during the battle against the Philistines. So the Philistines controlled the metalworking technology, specifically ironworking, which gave them a significant military advantage. The restriction was designed to keep the Hebrews subservient and prevent them producing weapons of war. If you look at your history, this is not a pro-Trump statement, just a fact statement. If you know what's taken place, if you go back to 1980 and multiple other times, what's been going on in all the different conflicts, from a human, militaristic, non-God obeying perspective, we had no choice than to try to eradicate the nuclear or nuclear, depending how you want to pronounce it, capabilities. Because we would be destroyed. No doubt about that. And so the Israelites were forced to pay the Philistines for sharpening tools like plowshares, mattocks, axes, and sickles. So what happened during the subsequent conflict, this lack of resources left the Israelite army severely under-equipped. In verse 20, but all the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen every man his share and his coulter, his axe, and his mattock. So they had to pay. And yet they had a file for the mattocks. You think, oh, a file, file it off the metal. Is that somebody? I heard a sermon like that one time. I'm like, seriously, read your Bible, do your research. They had a file for the mattocks and for the coulters, the forks, and the axes, and to sharpen the goads. It details the high cost enforced by Philistine blacksmiths for sharpening Israelite agricultural tools, highlighting Israel's technology, their dependence, and the lack of weapons. The cost was what's called a PIM, a PIM. It's approximately two-thirds of a shekel for plowshares, mattocks, and one-third shekel for axes and forks. The Philistines prohibited Hebrew blacksmiths to prevent them from forging weapons. The PIM was a specific weight measurement found in archaeology confirming the accuracy of the biblical text. So this economic oppression meant that at the time of battle, only King Saul and his son Jonathan had proper swords or spears. There was an extreme disadvantage of the Israelites, forcing them to rely on the enemy for tool maintenance. Now, the term file, which is Hebrew, PDSIRAH, in the King James Version refers to a tool, but more accurately in the context, the cost of the charge for sharpening the farming tools, the mattocks, the axes, the goads, that the Israelites had to pay the Philistines. Modern translations often interpret this as PIM, meaning a unit of weight of silver or a price, rather than a metal tool. So the word file was traditionally interpreted as a file or grindstone used to sharpen tools. That's not what it's talking about. Archaeological discoveries found weights inscribed with the word PIM, two-thirds of a shekel, indicating it was a fee. Most modern translations, the NIV, the NLT, read the charge was a PIM. Now, where it says bluntness, which is an alternative interpretation, some commentaries argue the word refers to the dullness or the edges of the tools. I don't see that. Because the Philistines controlled the ironworking, the Israelites were forced to pay a pretty high fee, a PIM, to sharpen their tools, highlighting their economic and military what? Subjugation to the Philistines, which is what it was always about. Okay. Verse 22. So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and Jonathan, but with Saul and with Jonathan, his son, there was found. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the passage of Michmash. Oh, why do they mention that? Because I think it's called Wadi Iswinite, something to that effect. You may remember that, Joe. It's a really deep gorge. So the garrison of the Philistines, they went out into that area And then next time in verse 14, which has an incredible amount of 52 verses, we are not going to get through that next time, but we'll get through maybe half of it, where we're going to talk about and see what Jonathan, what happens. So we got some time here. I buzzed through it, I know. And that's it. Or as Porky Pig would say, but that's all, folks. Now we can open it for discussion. Any comments, thoughts, things I missed? I'm sure someone will have something.
I had one
But
thought.
all right, Joe, you're only allowed one, uno, solo, no más.
So this period of time when Samuel was delayed almost seems as if that was a test for Saul to wait and not to be presumptuous. And not to
Absolutely.
take things into his own hands.
Absolutely.
So Samuel said 7 days, and he doesn't show up. So what do I do? What is Saul supposed to do here? What are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to be presumptuous and go off and do our own thing? It's
Let me,
some.
I got to tell this
And
other
also,
story.
that offering was only allowed to be made by the high priest. So it wasn't like it was any man could do it. It's like, well, he's not here, I'll do it. He had to be a high priest. And
I have to tell this story, and this is public, so I may get in trouble for this, but I won't mention names. But many years ago, a pastor that I was working with, the two of us had been out visiting brethren, several visits all day. And that night we had a spokesman club. You all know what a spokesman club is. And we were coming back, we'd stopped to eat. They had said it might snow. And so there was a little bit of snow coming down, but it wasn't bad. Wasn't supposed to get bad for 4 or 5 hours. Well, we pulled up and we stopped and ate lunch, dinner, and I was like, man, we were tired after visiting all day, but okay, we had a spokesman club and we were talking and what we were going to talk about and evaluation and both of us what we were going to say. And so we pulled into the parking lot. There was no light in the building and nobody there. Not a soul. And it was like 5 minutes before it was supposed to start. And so I looked at him and I said, did we miss something? Isn't tonight Spokesman Club? Yeah, this is whatever night it was, Wednesday night or Tuesday night. And yeah, it's club. And he said, this is really odd. And I said, well, it's not snowing heavy enough yet because people up there would still travel in the snow. It isn't like the people down here that if they talk about snow, they won't leave their house. And so he said, well, we didn't have cell phones at that point. So he said, well, I got to go make a phone call. So we drove away. We went to found a payphone, you know what those are, and called his wife and said, so and so, Scott and I are here at the spokesman club meeting, and there's not a soul here. She said, oh, yeah. She said, I knew you'd be calling. And his blood pressure went up and he started changing colors and he was upset. He said, what's going on? I said, I whispered, don't get mad at your wife. It's not her fault. She said, well, this certain elder had called her and said, I've canceled club because these two idiots are out visiting. They won't have enough common sense, so I've canceled it. And so he canceled it. And that phone call went around, and she said, my husband's not going to be happy when he hears this because he's the one that cancels it, not you. So that's a true story, but it's the same thing where, and when we went and talked to him later, he said, you don't do that. Boy, he just more excuses and got angry. And there was some correction that needed, but that was presumptuous to just, I took it upon myself because you, and he said, these two idiots won't know enough to cancel the spokesman club. And I just remember looking at the look on this guy's face and I'm thinking, oh man, you know. Things you don't do and shouldn't do. But so you may say, well, that's fine. He could have done that. Maybe that's how you think. But Saul here to do this was a really big thing that you don't do. Okay. I told that story. I'm probably going to regret it because somebody will listen to it and say, oh, that was. Anyway, anybody else? Okay, Joe, you can have one more since it's so quiet. You got one point. You
Course.
got another
I'm
one?
trying to be kind and quiet for everyone. No, I find it interesting the also the transition from brass to iron that's recorded here. I mean, it's not really in this particular chapter, but if you know about some of the ancient history in earlier places, the Israelites had swords of brass, and then later on they get iron. So there was a transition from kind of a copper-based weapon, which was more brittle, to the iron-based. And you're seeing that here play out in the actually in the text. So you have this slow progression of technology, like military technology, even at this point in time, showing the military advantage between, the Philistines and the Israelites. You find it interesting, though, that the Israelites always seem to be outnumbered and outgunned. And if they trust God, they win.
Man, isn't there a lesson there we could learn? Hint, hint, nudge, nudge, knock, knock.
Yeah.
Eric looks like that king from the Ten Commandments when he was sitting on his, his throne there. Just the red, the crimson red, the bald head, and just the patience, and like he's going to take a nap. It looks good, like he's really, yeah. Maybe he's playing that three-dimensional chess or jackal game. I don't know. Okay, anybody else? Gail, did you have a comment?
No, everything I was going to comment, you already mentioned.
Okay. Sorry about that. Bill Garrett. Come on, man. You got to have something.
Okay, in verse 3, where it says that Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land. So did they do it as a like a relay where they would blow it from one point and then blow the trumpet from another point, and then because that's a big area to try to cover with one trumpet.
I would say that is a logical assumption that probably what happened. It's like when there's a tornado siren goes off. It isn't just one, unless you're living in Milton, Wisconsin. But in a large city, you got to have multiple. When an air raid siren goes off, it's not just one. And sometimes there's a delay. But when it says all, I would say, did every single inch of the nation hear it? Maybe not. But the important parts, I would say, probably, yeah. But I don't have a specific answer because I have not been there when they blow the shofar or anything, the sound or the cassitar or any of the different trumpets. I've never heard that in person when there's an alarm. I've been in places when the sirens go off. I know living near off at Air Force Base, Strategic Air Command, what took place there as a youngster, it's kind of eerie when stuff goes off, so I've heard that, but I don't know. I would say your hypotheses would be as accurate as anything I could offer.
I think, I'm not sure if at this time, but I'm pretty sure at this time they had a way of communicating like the first of the month, a series of, I don't know, smoke
Signal
signals
fires.
or trumpets. So they had some sort of phone grapevine or, phone hookup like we would have to announce to everybody something. So if they're going to announce when the first of the month is, then they surely they could announce when, a certain trumpet blast, that meant go to war, and
Sounds
meant something
like a
else.
rooster.
So,
Sounds like a rooster. When I
So I
made
think there was a
the
particular sound they probably used to tell everybody.
when I made the comment about Saul had a large voice and a lot of that was a joke. There's no way he could have the whole nation. But here's the other thing: could God have magnified it? I don't know. Sometimes there's things we don't read. I don't know. I don't know. But I think your comment, Bill, is probably as accurate as anything any of I could offer. Joe, you may disagree, or Eric, or Clark, or Harry. But I don't know.
I
I
have
just,
a,
oh, go ahead. Ooh.
there are, well, there's actually documented signal what Jigel's talking about, which is announcing the months. They had signal fires. So once they had the court in Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin would make the determination, and they would light signal fires. And that was kind of the, because you could see it from a very far distance. You can, then propagate that. It's kind of a, simple technology to propagate a message.
I just looked up under Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary. So this is what it says. Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land. This is a well-known sound, was the usual Hebrew war summons. The first blast was answered by the beacon fire in the neighboring places. A second blast was blown, then answered by a fire in a more distant locality, whence the proclamation was speedily diffused over the whole country. As the Philistines resented what Jonathan had done as an overt attempt to throw off their yoke, a levy and a mass of the people was immediately ordered the rendezvous to be the old camping ground at Gilgal. So I guess there was some sort of.
That answers it, Bill, I think. I know in
Well.
Omaha, Nebraska, where I grew up, they had the Council Bluffs, which is right on the river, the Missouri River there, and the Indians, the Omaha Indians, did it, but they would have smoke signals back and forth. That's how they communicated. And the cartoons and the movies make fun of it, where the guy's waving the blanket and the puffs are going up, but that they did. They use that a lot. And I think of when there's a new pope elected, what happens? They all look to see at the chimney what color's coming out of the thing. I used to, as a firefighter, drive down the road, and I still do this. I see smoke and I'm like, oh, that's this, that's a factory, that's homes, that's grass, that's a chemical, that's turn around, go the other way. I've done that. Because And it's been a while, but there was a time where I could tell you by looking at generally the smoke and how it was rising. We had this. You ever wonder why at airports sometimes and around chemical plants you have those flying orange flags like a cone? You know what those are for? Because if there's a chemical spill, that's the first thing you look at. And you say, the wind's coming from this direction. We need to go the other direction as fast as we can because it's coming this way. And on an airport, when you come in, you're landing, you see that, you're like, okay, the wind just made a massive shift. We're going to have a problem. It isn't just for a flag that looks pretty or that thing, So I think that, Gail, is pretty accurate to answer Bill's question.
I'm satisfied.
Whew, good thing. That would have been, whew, we would have been in trouble. Thank you, Bill, for your kindness and compassion and generosity.
Anytime.
Okay. Anybody else? Any other thoughts? Eric the Red. Any comments from Eric the Red Blanket?
I don't, I'm just too worn out. My allergies
Okay.
are
You're forgiven. Okay.
bothering me.
No, I won't, but I won't. All right. All right. Anybody else have any thoughts? Do you think Saul could have handled this differently and the outcome would have been different? Have you ever had times in your life where you did something and you think, man, if I just done this way, this wouldn't have happened? We do it all the time, don't we? At least I do. Maybe you don't, but I do.
But none so momentous as what Saul did here. It seems as if I mean, but Samuel tells him is that this has broken your kingdom. I mean, this was like a massive mistake. But God must have known, I don't know, he must have seen the character flaw in Saul and tested him like that to see what he would do. My
Proverbs,
speculation.
yeah, Proverbs 3:5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will direct your paths, quote unquote, from the Authorized Version, King James Version. I think that verse could cover this story of this chapter. So, lessons learned for all of us, at least for me, and hopefully it was for you. So, let me see. Who prayed last time? All right. I'm not going to put somebody on the spot that I haven't asked ahead of time. So, other than my dear Gail, I ask you to close in prayer because Harry's in the hospital and he's probably tired. Anyway, go ahead, Gail. Would you please?
Most Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this time to be able to study your word together. We thank you for your inspiration and, well, foremost for having these stories written down so that we can learn from them, but help us to apply them to our own lives so that we don't make the same mistakes that others before us have made as lessons to us. So we ask that you would guide us and direct us in walking the path that you have directed that we can be faithful. Please be with my father and others as they suffer health challenges, that you would be with them, that you would bless the doctors that help them. And Father, intervene as your will is, but we do ask that you would be merciful. Thank you again for this time, and we look forward to the next time. We'll see you on this to be together again on the Sabbath and then next week. So we ask these things in Jesus Christ's name. Amen.